I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. I can still remember back in 2009 being captivated by the Ian Brown memoir, The Boy in the Moon. I interviewed Ian, I believe he was in a car, as he traveled from one television studio here in town to another back in the day when an author on tour could expect several broadcast media hits in Vancouver. I had a look at the book in advance of this interview now that I taped back in mid-March. It's still a beautiful book, frank and humane. In the book, Mr. Brown discusses what it was like raising a son with his wife, the writer Johanna Schneller, their daughter, as well as their caregiver. Walker, you see, was born with a rare genetic disorder. He has lived now with a severe disability for many years, and the book provided insight into what it was like for Walker growing up and the sorts of questions Ian contended with. In the 11 years since the book came out to rave notices and pretty good book sales, it has become a favorite of memoir enthusiasts, and I can think of several other authors who've appeared on this show who in their own works have cited Ian's book as encouragement, whether for writing or for looking at life. The book has inspired a theatrical adaptation, and it's because of that I spoke with the playwright Emile Scheer. He wrote the adaptation, and we talked about it in advance of the New World Theater production that was to have run at the Historic Theater at the Cult from late March into April. Because of COVID-19 and precautions over the coronavirus, the production at this point is postponed. When I talked to Mr. Scheer, we agreed we'd tape a conversation as if the show was to proceed, because even then it looked iffy. I told Emile I'd hold the tape until the show were to run, be it in the fall or later. But I like what we discussed, touching on this unique time, as well as fundamental questions The Boy in the Moon contends with, family, and the value we place on our lives and of those around us. Emile Scheer is known for his stage work for young and once-were-young audiences. He has adapted Hannah's Suitcase by Karen Levine and Roch Carrier's The Hockey Sweater for the stage. His other productions include Mourning Dove, Blue Nose, Derailed, and The Book of Ashes. His website is at emileshear.com. He joined me from Toronto the 15th of March, 2020. Please welcome to the Plant on the program, Emile Scheer. Mr. Scheer, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Thanks for joining us.
It's truly a pleasure to be here. I'm looking forward to making my way to Vancouver.
Yes, indeed, indeed. And like a lot of us, you first experienced Walker through the pieces that Ian Brown wrote in the Globe and Mail. Is that right?
Exactly. I read the beautiful feature on Walker and the photos that were included. I mean, I've always loved Ian's writing. I was familiar with his writing.
Yeah.
And I had a feeling then the power of his writing and the subject matter, you know, Walker, talking about, you know, the challenges and rewards of raising Walker, his son Walker, I almost instantly thought this would be a book. It was almost too good, too well written, too important not to become a book. And so when, in fact, it was published as The Boy in the Moon, I was sort of both half expecting it and also very heartened to see it come out as a book.
And that book, for people reminding, for people listening, just to remind them, when that came out, that was a huge success critically and commercially.
Absolutely. It won several awards, published internationally, and just it got a lot of attention, partly because I think what I migrated towards it for several reasons, but one is also I'm a parent. Mm. And I think you don't, not that you don't often, but I've given talks before about the need for this very type of dialogue, this type of conversation. Arthur Miller, I'm not sure if you're familiar, had a, I believe it was a son who was institutionalized, might have been a daughter, but he had a child who had been institutionalized for the longest time and basically hidden, kept out of sight, you know, by his choice.
Yeah.
And I kept thinking, imagine, you know, how we have a different world, certainly a different world in theater, if Arthur Miller had chosen to write about that experience, to share his thoughts on being a father. You may be familiar with the Kennedy clan. I'm sure you're familiar with JFK and his family.
Yeah.
One of JFK's sisters, same thing, the patriarch Joseph Kennedy, had her lobotomized because she had some type of intellectual disability. And so you had in the past all these people in positions of power, either politicians or playwrights, who were in a position to literally to have changed the conversation, and they chose not to, largely because of the climate at the time, if you will.
Yeah.
And then we have someone like Ian who comes along, who basically bears his soul to talk about the pain, and certainly there are moments of joy, of course, in raising a severely disabled boy like Walker. So I was really pleased to see that happen.
Well, what's fascinating, because I've been doing this show for a while now. When the book came out, I had Ian on. And I can count at least three or four different authors over the years who in their own books or in conversation with them cited this book as important to them in the writing of their own. I can't think of a book in the last 15 years or so published in this country that has had that sort of effect on other writers.
Yeah, interesting. Exactly, yeah.
And then it obviously it inspired you in terms of adapting it for the stage, didn't it?
I was drawn to Lockjaw because of form and content. The form being Ian's approach. It was in a novel, first-person memoir.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a wonderful ability of talking very honestly and with humor. You don't often expect that in a book talking about this. They say there's these really huge challenges he and his wife Joanna had in raising Walker. So I had a profound impact on me, not only as a parent, as I say, of two daughters myself.
Uh-huh.
The larger question to me was also one that Ian poses. What is the value of a boy like Walker Brown? And when we pose that question, it says as much about us, as I think, as it does about Walker.
Mm-hmm.
So what do we as a society collect? What's our responsibility towards the Walkers of the world? I was drawn to that big picture question, if you will. As a playwright, I thought it had this terrific possibility as a stage piece, and so I began to explore that.
Now, what are the challenges in terms of adapting a book like this for the stage? Surely you can't have every aspect of the book in the play, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And so I constantly, always a series of making choices, and so you always have to think dramatically, like what's going to engage an audience? And there are large stretches, in a book, in this book, where he talks about the medical community, the scientific research, that is certainly interesting, but it doesn't really make for wonderful theater, if you will. It's one thing to read it with a cup of tea by your side.
Mm-hmm.
It's another thing to see an actor perform these words, bring these words to life. And I felt the science just didn't lend itself to really the type of storytelling that I was interested in portraying on stage. So, I basically focused on the human side, if you will. The journey, Ian's journey, his relationship with Walker, his relationship with Joanna, his wife, his daughter, Haley, Olga, the nanny. So I wanted to almost give the human side, the human aspect, versus the scientific, not that scientists aren't human,
uh-huh.
but I think you know what I mean,
right.
to the story. So that was a big plus. Not knowing what it would look like as a stage play, because I knew it wouldn't be a conventional stage play in terms of sort of beginning, middle, and end, we have all this natural narrative arc that would unfold in a conventional play, but that didn't deter me from pursuing it.
And what were some of the conversations you had with Ian, with Joanna, with Haley, about turning it into a stage play? I mean, was this something that they were expecting, or did they want this?
I don't know if they're expecting it, but that's a really good question, because what I did from the beginning, as soon as I thought I really want to turn this into a stage play, I knew I was going to make one fundamental decision and choice. I wasn't going to limit it to Ian's voice. I had no interest in doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's certainly a legitimate choice. A playwright could decide, I'm going to just have to say literally a one-man show, a one-person show, as it is in the book, in a sense, all told through Ian's lens. And I thought for a host of reasons, it would be far more interesting and compelling to have Ian challenged, if you will, to have conflict at the base of all theater. And you can certainly have inner conflict, and Ian does, but I wanted to externalize it as well. So I said, I want to bring Joanna's voice into this play and Haley's, his daughter's voice. And so in both instances, I interviewed them and all of those transcripts into the play itself.
And when you do that, I mean, Walker is at the central, is central to this play, even though we don't see him in terms of, he's not a character. How do you then, as a playwright, portray him on stage
that's a great question.
Accurately?
That's a great question. And so, the beauty of theater in the hands of wonderful actors, and goodness knows this country we have many of them, thank goodness.
Right.
You can often create a character by how people respond to that person. So in other words, we can get a sense of a person's shape and who they are by the people around them, by the impact that they have on these people. And so in Ian's reflections and responses to Walker, and likewise Johanna and Haley, I think we get a very palpable sense of the profound impact that Walker's had. And through that process, we get a portrait of who Walker is. Because clearly we know he's limited. We couldn't have Walker as a physical, well, we could have. But I decided there wasn't, I don't think, much to be gained by having Walker on stage, knowing he was incapable of expressing himself through conventional language. So what you have is this family, and he's almost like the sun that everybody is orbiting around.
Mm.
And I think you get a real sense of who he is through, as they say, the reflections and what they say. And one thing we also do include are photographs. Ian talked, the photographs, as you know, punctuate the memoir.
Right.
And they're an effective way, I think, of just giving us a sense, one-dimensional to be sure, of Walker.
And giving us a sense of the disability that Walker has, how did you do that?
Again, through various ways, but partly through the description, just through Ian's wonderful prose. I often sort of joke, I said, Ian's written other books, and he wrote a book about Canadian Tire, and I had no interest in writing a stage play based on Ian's thoughts on Canadian Tire.
Uh-huh.
But it goes back to how he personalizes, you know, again, back to Arthur Miller and JFK, these other voices that we didn't hear about how does your life change? How do you adapt? What are the ways, the paths that you are set on with the arrival of a child like Walker? And so he describes in beautiful prose, as he's so adept at doing, what it's like to have a child like Walker. So it's not only the physical aspect of it. He talks about Walker hitting his forehead with such force, that he ends up wearing a helmet.
Mm-hmm.
And we hear that, those descriptions. And sometimes, of course, the power of imagination is such that it's more effective, more powerful to imagine it in our mind's eye than to actually see it. So when he talks about Walker bashing his head with his hands, if there's 200 people in the audience, there are 200 images of Walker doing that. And that in itself becomes really, really powerful. So there's the language itself, and there's ways, they can physicalize not so much the disability, but in their posture, silence can be very effective in theater as well.
Mm.
And there's just simple pauses in the play that we in the audience fill in with our own sense of our dread. What would I do in Ian's shoes, in Johanna's shoes, in Haley's shoes? So there's lots of blanks that we fill in as the audience, which I think contributes to the power of theater and to our sense of our own individual portrait of Walker as it's being brushed, so to speak, by Ian and Johanna and Haley.
Well, Emil, when this was first staged in 2014, what was the reaction from audiences at the time?
Again, largely, as you said, the way you responded to the memoir, it was very powerful. I think it just struck a chord because it's so, again, I keep going back to this word human. He makes the journey so human because it's such an abstract phrase. We talk about disability,
yeah,
or something like a Walker, a profound disability, a rare genetic mutation. These are words on a page. And what theater does, I think, so effectively is it makes it real and alive. One word we often associate with theater is intimacy. Because these are people, it's one thing to read the book. Here's Ian on stage. I mean, granted, it's an actor playing Ian,
yeah,
but we buy it. You know the power of theater. We're there with him. And to see this couple on stage share these personal struggles as if they're sitting in our living room, across from us on a chair, is very, very powerful. And I say that there's this intimacy of live theater that's very powerful and can strike a very deep chord. And on more than one occasion, I recall, having seen the play, of course, more than once in different productions in different cities,
uh-huh,
often people can't even bring themselves to applaud right away, when the lights go out at the very end of the play, because they're just almost stunned. They're still absorbing everything that they've been given for the previous 90 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I noticed in this production there will be emotional support workers available.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
And that's the whole genesis of the Vancouver production at New World Theatre. That began when an individual named Bill McKibben from the Rare Disease Foundation reached out to Ian, who in turn put him in touch with me, asking about he knew, having a child of his own with a rare disease, had heard about the Ottawa production at GCTC, heard about the Toronto production, had closed and wondered, was there any possibility of getting a production in Vancouver? And that began a bit of a conversation. It turned out that Marcus Youssef, who was then artistic director at New World Theatre, was interested in the play, and that led to a wider conversation. And here we are in spring 2020 with on the verge of mounting a production at New World Theatre.
What sort of conversations do you have with a production company like New World that's about to mount the show in terms of the show itself? Do they have a lot of questions for you, the playwright?
There's not often. Usually they would sort of take the script sort of as is. But again, timing is interesting. Here we are in spring 2020. There's a passage. I don't know if your listeners are familiar with an organization called Marsh. It's a wonderful community where you have able-bodied people, individuals called residents, living in homes with individuals called core members. And these are people with often profound disabilities. And a man, a Canadian, in fact, named Jean Vanier, in 1964, I believe, he invited two of these men, two middle-aged men with these disabilities, to live with him in a small town in France, in his home. And that became the beginnings of L'Arche. And L'Arche, this notion of L'Arche behind it, in a nutshell, is that we need to look upon the disabled as equals. Not that we're doing them a favor, not that they should be indebted to us, but almost the opposite, that they remind us of our own fragility, of our own vulnerability, and that we are equals. And we can learn as much from them as anything that we can give them. And that was certainly radical at the time, and it's become the norm now, and there are large communities around the world. So Jean Vanier had a profound effect on the way we see and the way we relate to those with disabilities. And as it turns out, it was recently disclosed that Jean Vanier, who was truly considered a saint by many, had been found to have sexually and emotionally abused at least half a dozen women during his lifetime. He passed away last year. So there was a passage that had been in the production where Ian talks about the impact that Jean Vanier had on him. And again, it was profound, and ultimately on his relationship to Walker. But we had to address it in the play. So I've been in constant conversation with Chelsea Haberlin, the director of the production, and Marcus, who's playing Ian, to address it, because it's like sort of the elephant on the stage, so to speak. It has to be addressed, and that's what we're dealing with now. How do we, on one hand, affirm the impact that Jean Vanier had on Ian in very, very positive and meaningful ways, and at the same time not shy away from the fact that we have since learned he was involved in some despicable behavior. So that's a perfect example. But there are times where I may get a particular line, maybe something that's misunderstood, and a director will call me up and say, can we address this? Can we unpack this together?
And by the way, it was Ian who broke the story, wasn't it, in the Globe and Mail?
Exactly. The Globe and Mail had exclusive access to this report. And to L'Arche's credit, when they got wind of these allegations, they investigated the initial allegation against Vanier, and then a second woman came forth only months before Vanier passed away last year. And they took it very seriously and did an inquiry and came out with this damning report. I think it was February of this year.
I remember I read that late at night on my phone. And as soon as I saw the byline, it was Ian Brown in the Globe and Mail.
You can just imagine what went through, and that's what we're going to put that into the play as well.
Really?
Ian's reactions? What was his response to have somebody I don't want to say he deified him, but somebody he really, really admired him, to just have that shattered is just really, really difficult.
Yeah.
And at the same time, not to deny, as I say, that Vanier's teachings has had a tremendously profound and positive effect.
Indeed. Emile, you have written for different audiences over the years.
I have.
Young versus, say, adults.
That's right.
Are you literally donning different hats as you write?
I do. I wear many. Sort of my little motto, if you will, is I go where the story takes me. So if something gets me out of Ian's beautiful series in the Globe and Mail did, I often have almost a visceral response of how well can this story be told. And I immediately thought stage play. You know, as a film, could it work as a film? Like, could. But this goes back to what I mentioned before about the intimacy of live theater.
Yeah.
Of course, it had already been done as a book. There are other instances where I read a beautiful essay in the New York Times about a young, he's now a man, at his mother passed away when she was fairly young, and he discovered these little notes that they had exchanged when he was a child. Excuse me, little sticky notes almost.
Yeah.
And he found that his mother had laminated them. And I found that just profoundly moving, and it just came to me, the idea of a picture book for children that's told entirely through sticky notes. Mm. And so that's the genesis of that picture book for children. So again, another story told for a very different audience, but it goes back to this notion of, here's a story that speaks to me, that I want to be able to tell to another audience, whether initially an essay in the New York Times or an article in the Globe and Mail, how can I best tell that story? And that's the genre where I find myself. I work in screenplays. I've written screenplays and essays, and as you say, plays for both young and old. And even as a playwright, given the topic matter, do I shape it as a play for adults or for younger audiences, for families?
And as a writer, reading is obviously a very important part of your day, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. That's one of the cardinal rules of anyone. Anyway, often certainly students who come up and say, I want to be a writer one day. And probably the two rules is, one of them is just write. Writers write, and writers read. And so, and reading, you know, even with stage plays, it's a good point you're raising, because I've gone to stage plays that didn't do it, you know, that just didn't work for me, that I thought maybe had failed for various reasons, but I never see it as a lost opportunity. And again, when I give talk to sometimes writer craft students in high school, and I say, well, if you didn't like the play, ask yourself why. Why wasn't it working? You know, so there's always something to be gained from the experience of hearing a story. And so keep reading. If there's a story you're reading that's not working for you, don't just put it down, toss it, and pick up something else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, ask yourself some real fundamental questions of why isn't it working? What would you do differently? Take it apart. You know, so don't only read wonderful works of art. Occasionally, if you stumble upon something that's not engaging you, don't stop there. Keep going.
Now, we live in such an uncertain time.
More than ever.
Yeah, this show seems like an ideal one to see, doesn't it?
Well, you know, it's a really interesting point, because it sort of, I think it grounds us, you know, in this particular time with the coronavirus and people just almost going to extremes and in despair, and things are so topsy-turvy. Certain phrases I go back to, and one of them are truths, and I think art, capital A art, if you will, because it sounds, you know, a bit precious, but reveals fundamental truths about who we are. That is what the best stories do. That's why I was drawn to a Ian's memoir, because it reveals, I think, just some really important basic truths that we have to be reminded of. And apropos even the coronavirus that we're living through now, and these days of despair for many, mm-hmm. you know, at the heart of Ian's book, I believe, is this question of what do we owe each other?
Yeah.
And all the more so that, of course, the walkers of the world, but that applies to everything. What do we owe each other? You know, are we sort of here for each other or not?
Yeah.
And that's certainly apropos. I think that's relevant any time, you know, at any time, all the more so during the times of crisis, where sometimes it's you know, we see people hoarding and whatnot, and we take this me-first attitude. Granted, it's in a different context, but I do believe the stories that endure, and Ian's story has endured, and I think will endure, they offer some sometimes difficult truths, but important truths that I think we really should give thought to.
Yeah, and then that's the beauty of theater, isn't it? That's the magic of theater, that one can sit in an audience and realize those important truths.
And you can see that, and when you see those truths revealed in the moment, sometimes it could just be silence. It could be two people looking at each other. Music can be very effective. There's in one of the productions of the play, I actually spoke with the nanny. Her name's Olga, Walker's nanny.
Uh-huh.
Who still talks to the family. Still sees Walker. He comes home for 3 days every 2 weeks now,
mm-hmm.
and she was intricately involved in helping to raise Walker. And I had a conversation with her, hoping I could weave some of her thoughts into the play. In the end, she was quite shy and reserved, and I couldn't get much out of her. But one of the things she does is she just sings and plays Walker, you know, all day long. And she just has songs where she just claps her hands and sings Ears Hang Low, you know, which is a song, you know, familiar to many.
Yeah.
And in the play, there's moments where we hear Olga just humming Do You Ears Hang Low. And Ian had a phrase where he talked about a time when he was on, I think it was in a canoe with Walker, and there was Olga, the nanny, singing from a nearby porch off, you know, on the shoreline. And he talked about puffs of love. That's a beautiful phrase, puffs of love.
Yeah.
And so here is this woman, this nanny, who had given her heart and soul to Walker, sending these puffs of love, and that's Ian's phrase. And so when you hear a phrase like that, it can just stop you. And again, the beautiful thing about theater, as you say, the intimacy and the live theater, the magic of it, is that we can just let it wash over us. We're just absorbing that, you know, there we are in the audience listening, and we're just letting the words just coat us, if you will. And we leave, ideally, somewhat changed, could be in subtle ways, in ways we're not even aware. But I think when live theater works, it changes something within us.
Indeed.
And I can, to this day, I have memories of plays I saw 40 years ago. That just a moment in a play that has stayed with me ever since.
Yeah. You are scheduled to be out here to give conversations pre-show.
Yeah.
I should mention pre-show because we want people to get there early. Because they usually think these things happen at the end of the show.
No, so good point.
It's March 31st and April 3rd, 6:30 to 7:15 before curtain.
Exactly.
And people can get information on the website. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you. As I said earlier, this is a book that had such an impact on me when I read it, when I talked to Ian about it, and then, as I said, subsequent conversations with other authors. Later on over the years. I can't wait to see this show. Thanks for your time today. Break a leg, as they say.
A real pleasure, and thank you for your interest and helping to spread the word. That's also really a part of the big picture that we all have to do is not only creating stories, but letting people know about the stories.
The website for more is at emilescher.com. Visit New World Theater's website regularly for updates on when this production will resume, if ever. Emile Scher joined me on the line from Toronto in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.